Our meeting for February 9th will come to order. This is the Education Innovation Policy Committee. And today we have a very important topic on our agenda. So it is great to have so many visitors, great testifiers today. You're going to learn very, very important information, everyone. And I would like, Representative Jessup, would you move approval of the minutes from February 7th?
I move for approval of the minutes, Madam Chair.
Representative Jessup moves approval of the minutes from February 7th. Are there any corrections or additions? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those who oppose, nay. The motion prevails, and the minutes from February 7th, 2017 are approved. First on our agenda this morning, members, is what I call a vehicle bill, and I'm sorry that Representative Mariani's not here yet, but as chairs, we always put a few files on the general register just in case we need to work from that perspective. So I'm going to move House File 836 to be placed on the general register. So members, if you would pull that out of your file. This is something that's already in law, character development education, most appropriate today when we are delving into discipline policy and the working group report on discipline. It adds just an important line to character development education, and that it is a shared responsibility of parents, teachers, and members of the community who jointly support positive character development. As you know, this legislation is an encouragement, so it's not a mandate. But I am pleased to say that I have one district that uses character education as one of its focus, and it really is very rewarding to learn from the students what they learn about respect, honesty, responsibility, and citizenship. Very great experience for me to talk to those students as I send them congratulatories every week. So are there questions about 836? Seeing none and hearing none, the chair will renew her motion that House File 836 be placed on the general register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails, and 836 will be placed on the general register. Members, that brings us to our topic for today, school discipline. And I'd like to call forth Ed Graff, the superintendent of Minneapolis Schools, and anyone, Mr. Graff, that you would like at the table with you to assist in your presentation. Members, later we will hear the task force report, but first we want to get an update on what is happening in our school systems, particularly Minneapolis and St. Paul. As you know, we want our children to be safe, but we also want our teachers and staff to be safe. And we've had some incidents over the past few years that have been less than disturbing, or maybe more than disturbing. And for that reason, we want an update on what is happening, what policies might be changing. It is always not necessary for a law to be enacted, but we want to be the support system. And because we have the working group on discipline and know that there will be some legislation, we want this prelude to that. So welcome very much, Mr. Graff, and will you say your name for the record and begin?
Ed Graff. Madam Chair, committee members, thank you. My name is Ed Graff, the new superintendent of Minneapolis Public Schools. Would like to thoroughly thank you for the opportunity to speak to you about this important issue of school safety. I'm pleased to be joined here today by the district's Chief of Academics, Leadership and Learning, Michael Thomas, and our Chief Assessment, Innovation and Research Officer, Eric Moore. And they're here in the event you have follow-up questions or need additional information regarding our statistics in Minneapolis. I also want to acknowledge one of our graduates from Henry High School, Representative Fu Lee. Good morning, Representative. You do MPS proud with your service here, so we're grateful to have you on board here today. Like some of you, I was born in Greater Minnesota, Bemidji, actually. Both my parents were educators, and my early school years were spent in rural parts of the country, both in South Dakota and Alaska. I returned to Greater Minnesota, where I graduated from high school at McGregor High School. many, many years ago. To begin this conversation, I think it's important to anchor it in our children. As you know, our kids move within a complex system, largely constructed by adults. Our streets, our homes, our places of worship, our justice system, our seats of government, and of course our schools are just some of these systems. And these systems are greatly interconnected. And that's why our schools reflect what's going on in the broader community. If there's trauma in our streets and in our homes, then it comes into our schools. If there's instability in housing, in health care, and if there's insufficient mental and physical health care, if there's hunger, homelessness, all these factors show up in powerful ways in our classrooms. Our job as educators is to try and understand our students, the systems they're moving through, and how we can make sure that we are serving their unique needs and addressing their academic, social, and emotional well-being. I personally believe it's the most meaningful and impactful work that we do in our country. And it's incredibly urgent. And that's why I'm honored to serve as the Minneapolis Public Schools' new superintendent. I think it's also notable that the vast majority of our teachers and students report feeling safe in our schools. It's also worth pointing out that we have some of the highest achieving schools in the state. And Madam Chair, Henry High School, from which Representative Lee graduated, has an 87% on-time graduation rate. 93% of the students at Henry High School are students of color. 85% qualify for free and reduced lunch. And so we're very proud of the work that's going on at Henry High School. We know that we have a great deal of strength in Minneapolis public schools, for sure, but it's also undeniable that Minneapolis students are living in some of the highest concentrations of poverty in the state, and we struggle with issues of instability, trauma, and homelessness. So what does instability mean for our schools? For example, on average, 33% of our students in our classrooms change over a given year. Imagine that. 33% of our students, on average, will change schools over a given year. In the neighborhood in which Henry is thriving, our kids are experiencing real challenges. Aggravated assaults are up 39% in the community. Weapons offenses are up 300%. Homelessness is real. Poverty is real. Lack of good-paying jobs is real. Housing instability is real. All of these factors play a significant role in our education system. So we have to account for this in our schools. We have to do everything we can to show up for our students, for kids, and ensure we're engaging them, challenging them, holding them to high expectations, and supporting them building positive and trusting relationships. And I want to share just briefly some of those things that we're doing in our schools to do this. First, we're taking a look at our data. We're evaluating the data at the district and at school levels in a much deeper way, using that data to drive our decisions about our interventions that we're putting in place and our responses. Principals and instructional leadership teams are able to use the data to evaluate trends and areas where they need support, which has led us to recent decisions to make strategic investments at our middle schools and our high schools in staff, specifically to support the climate and culture in our schools. At the district level, we're using this data to drive similar discussions. In fact, to immediately address some of the student conflicts we're seeing in the schools in the first half of the year, I've directed my staff to redeploy resources or personnel from our Davis Center and send them directly into our schools. And they will be our boots on the ground, if you will, to support our teachers and administrators for the remainder of this school year. We're also increasing our professional development as it pertains to the culture and climate in our schools across the board. We've placed a particular emphasis on teaching de-escalation techniques, including from the nationally recognized Crisis Prevention Institute. Our schools are developing conflict mediation services for students to resolve these conflicts before they escalate. And all schools have created positive school-wide engagement plans targeted toward their unique school climate. Additionally, we've moved to provide mental health professionals in our schools, and we don't just do this alone. We partner with community-based organizations to address deep-level mental and emotional health of our students. And, of course, as part of my job as superintendent, is to share with you my thoughts around the role that you play and how we can collaborate and develop a stronger relationship. The legislature and governor are, of course, critical partners in helping us stabilize our families and providing greater access to affordable housing, ensuring schools have mental health services are just two areas where your work is greatly needed. The governor has recently proposed $110 million in bonding to create affordable housing across Minnesota. I ask you respectfully to please adopt that. The governor is proposing an initiative called Homework Starts at Home, which will help low-income families stay in their apartments and provide resources for homeless students, of which we have 3,200, or 8% of our population in our school district. Again, I request respectfully for you to adopt that. As my team worked to pull together our legislative agenda, we went out to our students and we talked to them about what they felt we needed as priorities. One of our high school students said she was 30th on the wait list to meet with a school therapist. That school is rallying counselors and social workers to assist, but they're overwhelmed with requests for help from our students. Please expand the school-based mental health grants. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk with you today. Appreciate the attention that's being given on the climate within our schools. And as I said earlier, this is a tremendous priority for me, for our teachers, for our administrators, for our families, and especially for our students. No matter where you live in Minnesota, I think we can all agree that if our students don't feel physically safe, emotionally safe, then they can't learn. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Graf. My question is, last year, in this past session, 2016, we did include in the supplemental bill a directive that that teachers would have the authority, you know, over their students in the classroom, and also that they would be cognitive of or cognizant of any assaults that had occurred as a result of student behavior. So what is Minneapolis, or what have you done to ensure that that directive has been honored?
Madam Chair, as a former classroom teacher, administrator, and now superintendent, I can tell you that the relationships that students have with their teachers are paramount to their learning. And I absolutely agree that a teacher needs to understand how their child is, how their students are showing up in their classroom. So one of the things we have to continue to do is make sure that we have time to understand those students as they transition into our district. So we have systems in place where we have team meetings and talking about what the needs of students are and how they're showing up in our schools. As I mentioned earlier, with 33% of our students on average transitioning from one school to the next during the school year, ensuring that they have a good understanding of their students as they come in is very critical.
Mr. Graf, to what extent are parents involved in the decisions that are made in regard to behavior in the Minneapolis system?
As part of the, Madam Chair, as part of the process for addressing behavior of students, I go back to what I refer to as the ABCs. So if you have an incident that occurs, and you know it can range from just a minor incident in the classroom to a much more public incident, but you start first by understanding what took place, the antecedent, what prompted this situation occurring. Then you look at the behavior itself, what were the actions that occurred from the individuals involved in the event. And then the third part of it, the C part of it, is the consequence, understanding what the consequences were because of those behaviors and how you address that moving forward. So that process is part of what takes place, as well as the due process of any student in any kind of infraction that we have in the schools. But certainly parents play a huge role in understanding how their child is behaving in the classroom, and then making sure we connect with the families to prevent these kind of things from occurring in the future, and use this as a learning opportunity for our students, as well as connecting greater with the family to understand if there are other challenges that they're facing outside of the school that may play a part in this incident or any other incident.
Mr. Graff, I noticed that the MDE Disciplinary Incidents Report System, the DIRS, reported that most common incidents in our schools are disruptive or disorderly conduct or insubordination and fighting, of course. So at what level are you seeing that occur? Is it in the early years? Does it continue? Or do you see some kind of change occurring as staff works these problems? So comment on from, you know, the K-2 through the middle years through high school, where the incidence of that, because I certainly know as a former classroom teacher that, you know, there were behaviors that were not appropriate at certain times. But in my world of the high school, it might have been, you know, other things that brought on the disruptive behavior, you know, maybe a girlfriend issue or a weekend issue or something like that. But yours are much deeper than that, and I think they are throughout the state and the nation deeper than that today. But is it occurring as early as, you know, K-2?
Madam Chair.
And to what extent?
I think if we all reflect on our educational experiences, we know that there were times when conflicts happened in our schools, in our own personal lives. And I think what's changed to some degree is the influence of social media and how that is perpetuated from time to time. So depending on the age, we're going to see different types of incidents. In our younger students, we're really emphasizing the conversation around responsible decision-making, good choices. Are these small problems? Are these big problems? So how do they navigate and mediate some of those conflicts that they're having? So being very intentional about that with our younger students, developing those skills with them. As you mentioned, perhaps as they get older, students have other factors that they're dealing with, physiological factors, community factors that play a part, again, due to the mobility that they might have in their home situation or the instability in their housing and with their families. And so we do our best with the resources that we've been given to try and support that in our schools by making sure that they have those strong connections with their teachers. And I also tell you that as our students get older, having more exposure to some of these practices of developing those conflict resolution skills, we're able to minimize some of that concern around behaviors, you know, whether it's the disobedience that you mentioned or the aggressive behavior in our classrooms. But I will go back to that our students and the schools that we have are a reflection of our community. And I think the obligation we all have collectively is to address those needs in the community. And these, you know, the needs that we're talking about here in Minneapolis are of a much greater concentration because of the poverty that we have in our schools, in our community. But it exists everywhere in greater Minnesota. I know that from my upbringing, that these needs that we're talking about of support for housing, for employment, for mental health, stabilizing families, that's a statewide piece.
Representative Lee, you have a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just wanted to share with everyone here today that I wouldn't be here, you know, as a member of the House of Representatives without the influence of a lot of my educators or teachers over at Henry High School. And I don't know if I have shared this with Superintendent Graff, but I still remember a particular situation in 10th grade in English class, and this writes, and this was right after Congressman Nelson got elected to the U.S. Congress. And remember we having a conversation about this, and she told me at that time that, Fu, one day I could see you doing something like this for our community here in Minneapolis, especially for the north side. And I think that it's really important to have a relationship with a trusting adult outside of our parents. And I really appreciate all of our educators, especially those serving on the committee too. And I just want to say thank you all to our educators in here. And with that said, I just wanted to let everyone know on the committee that over at Henry High School, 85% of the graduating class last year attended college, and many of these students, like myself, are the first in their families to attend college and to graduate from college. So, Superintendent Graff, Could you explain the importance of high expectations for all of our students in the district?
Superintendent Graff.
Madam Chair, Representative Lee, first of all, I want to thank you for highlighting your attendance to Patrick Henry High School. I spend time in our schools each week, and just a couple of weeks ago, spent time at Patrick Henry sitting down with students. One of our school board liaison students, past school board liaison, student representative, attends Patrick Henry High School. And I can tell you that the interaction that I saw from the students with the teachers was exactly what we're looking for, those strong connections. So it's really important that we continue with that. The idea of high expectations, I think, is something that we don't highlight enough. Making sure that we set the bar for our students in a way that they can see a vision of what is potential, what their potential is, or what the future may look like for them is really, really important. We have to also couple that with high support, though. As students are navigating, you know, some of the experiences that they have out in their community and learning more about who they are as young men and women, we have to make sure that they have that support to keep them strong and focused on what they can do. So we work really hard to set those expectations for our students. We have to do a much better job of making sure that we have those supports in place. And we're doing our best in our schools to do that as we reflect on our data and seeing what their needs are. But again, I will say we have to have that out in our community. And to reinforce that point, I will share with you one of my first interviews that I had as the new superintendent was with a group of young students from the north area of Minneapolis. And one of the young ladies asked me, she said, what are you going to do to help support mental health in our schools? And I thought for a minute, okay, who set me up on this one? This is a 10th, 11th grade student asking me about mental health. And so I asked her, I said, where did you get such a thoughtful or insightful question about mental health at your age, you know, in the schools? And she said, because it personally affects my family. She said, my family has challenges in the area of mental health. And I think I might need help as well, and I don't know what to do and how to get that. So the point to be made here is that we can have high expectations for our students, but we also have to recognize their needs and make sure that we have the high support that we're providing as well. And again, I feel like that's part of what we can do together to improve things.
Madam Chair.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, and I don't know if Superintendent covered this in his remarks too, but I just want to let community members know that U.S. News and World Report recently ranked Henry High School as the third best school in the state of Minnesota. And with our discussion on student misconduct and disciplinary issues today, I just wanted to ask you, what role do you see with regards to the relationship building between staff and student in creating a successful learning environment?
Superintendent Graff.
Madam Chair, thank you. If I may at this time ask Chief Thomas to come forward and speak to some of those transitions that occur in our schools that are so critical to help students. Because, I think that what we're talking about are layers of building blocks for our students from early on in the pre-K that we're doing to get students ready for kindergarten, and then as they transition into the middle years in high school, those relationships that they have not only with their teachers, but with the school as a whole, are very, very important. So I'd like to ask Chief Thomas to speak a little bit about those transitions and the support that we have.
Welcome to our committee, Chief Thomas. Will you say your name for the record and then begin?
Sure. My name is Michael Thomas. Madam Chair, committee members, thank you for this opportunity to share some of the aspects that are happening within Minneapolis Public Schools. And you know, to the most recent question, I think one of the things that we really pride ourselves in Minneapolis is that, you know, we take our students as they come, and we know that they come with a variety of histories and a variety of aspirations, and we try to meet the students and the families where they're at. That's critically important. And, you know, one of the things that we adopt is really being culturally and linguistically responsive to our students. And you heard Superintendent speak to a variety of systemic and kind of cultural components within Patrick Henry, and I would say that is the norm that we are aspiring for all of our learning communities. We know that high expectations are one of the leading indicators with regards to culturally linguistic and responsive learning environments. so that we want to have positive perceptions on our students as well as our families, and that is the mindsets that we enter in, as adults into those spaces to support our kids. We know that some of the critical transitions for our students, whether it's moving from third grade to fourth grade, where they're learning to read and then reading to learn, and we're looking at those critical transitions at middle school, at sixth grade, and those entry points at our high school at ninth grade. Those are some of our critical touch points that we provide a lot more intense support to ensure that our students are making it through those transitions successfully. One of the most recent things that we'd like to highlight is our Freshman on Track work that we're doing at many of our high schools, at all of our high schools, where we are working with students in eighth grade and students who are going into ninth grade at that critical transition year to ensure that we are setting a strong foundation for those students at their ninth grade year so that they will graduate on time and be college-bound and or career-bound as well. One of the other aspects is that we have a variety of our positive school-wide engagement teams superintendent spoke to, and those teams exist at all of our schools. Those teams are developing comprehensive school-wide strategies to support the learning environments of all students so that they are monitoring the performance of our students not only academically but also the social and behavioral components of our students as well. And so when we identify a student who might be experiencing some challenges, that student is identified early where we can understand the challenges that that student is going through, put together an individual support plan for that student, and then to be able to monitor the progress that student makes so that we can ensure that they remain successful. But again, there are a variety of components that we put into play in our schools that allow us to be the best support, the high support that our superintendent references to ensure that we get the outcomes for our kids.
Thank you.
Mr. Thomas, I'm looking again at this data from the department, and it's noted that most incidents occur in the classroom, almost 50%, followed by the hallway at 21%. Outdoor areas, 13%. So I want to go back to the question I asked Superintendent Graff earlier about where are you seeing this begin and to what extent, you know, at what grade level, and then what are you doing to help the teachers? Because they are center stage, and they're the ones developing the relationships but delivering at the same time the instruction and checking the progress of their students. And as a former teacher, I know how important that is and how you have to know each student in a certain way to address their needs. But could you comment on that, please?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. When we take a look at the data in our school system, where we see a natural trend upward is when students begin entering the middle grades. And I think if you just understand our own middle school experiences and what is happening with us socially and emotionally at that time, that is where we see a lot of our incidents begin to be identified. Over this past school year, we have made significant investments in providing professional development for our middle school deans, who are many of our middle school and high school deans. Those are the individuals whose primary responsibility is to support strong, supportive learning environments at our schools. We've also taken in some of that professional development and provided that to our classroom teachers. We want to make sure that lower-level behavior infractions, level ones and level twos, if you will, are effectively managed in the classroom. As we heard from Representative Lee, that primary relationship in our schools, first and foremost, is with our classroom teachers. So we want to empower our classroom teachers with the tools and resources that they would need to ensure that they can maintain that relationship with students. We take a very restorative approach in Minneapolis Public Schools. We do not want to tell our kids, if you will, that when you make a mistake that you're no longer welcome. It's just the opposite. We know that students are going to make choices that would not align to what we would expect for them. And then when that does, we want to be able to process with our students, first and foremost in that classroom, if not other caring adults in that school system, to ensure that they can understand kind of the antecedent, where we can support that behavior. If there's a need for any type of consequence, that obviously would be issued. But we're trying to restore that student back into that learning environment as quickly as possible because that's where the support remains. And so we've done a lot of investment in Minneapolis at that middle and high school level to build those comprehensive teams, but also provide that individualized support for our teachers.
So, Mr. Thomas, can a teacher then have the child removed and placed in another learning environment during that kind of timeout period? I mean, are you providing that so that the teacher has an ability to continue to teach instead of being disrupted and the whole lesson falls apart?
Madam Chair, that's exactly what happens when you think about a student who's making a not-so-appropriate choice in a classroom. We look at alternative to suspension, if you will. And again, suspension is reserved for very high, high-level offenses. But when we're looking at students who are making, disruptive choices in the classroom, yes, we're looking at the elementary school, for example. You'll see that more prevalent. Paired classrooms where I might be asked to join another teacher's classroom for a change of context, and maybe that will allow me to kind of process or focus differently and then, again, re-entering back into my primary classroom. At the middle school, we also have staff and resources, whether it's our counselors and social workers, where our students could actually step out from the classroom in process with another individual so that they can return back to that learning environment. So we look at a lot of alternative ways to ensuring that if a student does have to be removed from that primary source of instruction, we are working as quickly as we possibly can to bring the right supports to that student, as well as bringing that right support back to that classroom so that they can thrive and be successful.
Superintendent Graff, did you want to comment on that?
Madam Chair, thank you. I wanted to bring to light an experience I had earlier this year where I was at a middle school and witnessed what Chief Thomas just described, where a student needed to be in a different environment talking through some of the challenges that they were having. The interesting note is that when I was talking with the principal about this, he said, every Monday we restart. Mm-hmm. Students come back from the weekend and we restart again. So Mondays are a day when there's a lot of energy going on in the school, and what they've done is they've created an opportunity for these kind of situations to be addressed outside of the regular classroom so that they don't have that, they're able to minimize the disruption by taking those students into another space in the building and having conversations about what they need to do to recalibrate or restart the students. And he said, the more we can have our students consistently in our schools over a period of time, the more success we have in getting them to feel comfortable, make those connections, and understand exactly what we're doing. So I think the point I wanted to make there is that we do have those structures in place, but again, we're looking at how they're impacted by some of the community factors or the outside forces of kids coming in from whatever they're experiencing over the weekend and having to restart that.
Representative Christensen, you had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Superintendent Graff, I missed writing it down. What did you say the graduation rate at Henry High School is?
I have to look at my notes here, Madam Chair.
Superintendent Graff. I think it was 87%, wasn't it?
Madam Chair, Representative, 87% of the students at Patrick Henry graduated on time.
Representative Christensen.
Madam Chair, Superintendent Graff, thank you for that. I mean, that's great news. I wasn't aware of some of the great work at Henry High School that's going on, so I'm appreciative to you for sharing that. I'm looking for what do you think are some of the differences between what's going on at Henry High School and at some of the other schools in the district? Obviously, Henry High School has a graduation rate something like 37% higher than the overall district average. So what would you say is going on differently at the other schools besides Patrick Henry? Are you trying to replicate what's happening at Patrick Henry at other high schools? How are you doing it, and what kind of progress has been made?
Superintendent Graff.
Madam Chair, Representative, I think that what we've done at Patrick Henry is in part what they've done for the messaging in the community. They have those high expectations. They have programming for students where they've developed teams within their staff, and they've really looked at the students as individuals and created kind of plans for each student as to how they're going to be successful. I again had the opportunity a couple weeks ago to be in the building, and I was walking through the hallway with the principal, and he stopped, connected with a couple of students and said, I want you to come and talk to me. You're doing a presentation this Friday. I want to see what that presentation looks like. That is exactly the type of connection that we want for our students, where they know that they are, again, held accountable to high expectations, and then they have the support. So the principal took 15, 20 minutes to sit down with these two young men and work through a PowerPoint, and it actually, it wasn't him telling them what to do. It was the students processing with him what they were going to do. So they had that individual ownership. So that's a very concrete example of what I'm seeing in Patrick Henry and what I'm seeing in the schools. When I talked to the student representative about what she felt was taking place, she explained that she had teachers who had high expectations for her, who were offering classes, advanced classes, IB classes, where students could excel, where teachers were trained in high-quality instruction, delivering those high expectations for students. And with that, we had a reputation that was developed there that people were drawn to that kind of school. So I think a lot of what's been happening there is based upon the narrative that they're trying to describe through the work that the students are doing. The students have a wonderful robotics team and just had an event a couple weeks ago where they have had robotics students coming out performing, and again they're building that momentum. So for me it's about the engagement. It's making sure that we have engaging opportunities for our students, and the more continuity we can provide in our system, I think the greater success we're going to see.
Representative Christensen.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Superintendent Graff. So that's obviously, a great graduation rate, but obviously a really important indicator of how students are doing and how they're being prepared in the K-12 system is how they're doing in college. And do you know what the remediation rate at Patrick Henry High School is?
Superintendent Graff, Representative Christensen, you mean when they go out to college?
Yes.
How many need to be remediated?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay. Superintendent Graff.
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't have that information, but we can certainly get that for you. I think specifically what you're asking for, we would have to draw from the universities and see what students are going into the schools.
Representative Christensen?
Madam Chair, would somebody from, I know the department has that information, would it be easily available for them to inform us this morning, or
sure.
Would maybe they need more time?
I think I see Mr. Oney coming down. Representative Christensen was the chief author of the discipline bill this past session, so he is very concerned about the progress that's being made. Mr. Oney, welcome. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Madam Chair, members, good morning. My name is Adosh Oney. I'm the Government Relations Director from the Minnesota Department of Education. Representative Christensen, we are currently working with the Office of Higher Education on constructing the Getting Ready report, and from there we can draw out a lot of that information that you're looking for, but it's still in the process of creating that right now. And I think it will take a little bit of a lift to get specific district information. I haven't had a specific district information request personally, but I can always go back to staff, and we can get back to the committee when that information is available.
Thank you. Representative Christensen?
Madam Chair, Mr. Oney, thank you for that. I appreciate that information. I appreciate your your work on that. I know we've heard a lot of testimony in this committee as well as the Higher Education Committee from students, former students, Minneapolis students, who talk about getting great grades in high school at Minneapolis and being on the honor roll and all these things. And essentially, every indicator was that they were very completely prepared for college, ready for success. And then they got to college, to oftentimes Minnesota State schools, and they needed extensive remediation, which cost them more money and cost them more time. And then they can't graduate from college on time, and they have more debt. And I think that's been really concerning for members of this committee and really just parents and stakeholders in this, that students are essentially going to school and being told by administrators and teachers and everyone that they're prepared for college. We heard from somebody who had a 4.0 in high school, and you know, I think if I didn't have a 4.0 in high school, and I think, you know, if you have a 4.0 in high school, you really ought to be prepared for college. And this student was got to college, and she wasn't even close to adequately prepared. So I guess my question is, you talk about the high standards. It seems like in a lot of cases these high standards are not standards that necessarily prepare kids for life after high school. So how are you trying to make sure that your standards are actually preparing kids for college?
Superintendent Graff.
Madam Chair, Representative Christensen, I want to acknowledge as someone who went to high school in Minnesota here and then went on to college, I too struggled with those transitions. But it wasn't about the academics. It was about my ability to understand what type of learner I was, where my strengths were, and what I needed to do to improve things. And so as we talk about those transitions where students are going from a place of school in their community to maybe a different environment or into the workforce, we're really talking about what are those skills they have, the ability to navigate, to be creative problem solvers. And that's a lot of the work that I think I bring to Minneapolis Public Schools when we talk about how do we support students to be well-rounded citizens. You know, you can't just have the academics. They are extremely important. You have to have students who are proficient, highly proficient in math, reading, and writing. You also have to have students who are able to critically navigate some of the obstacles that are out there, whether it's figuring out how to self-manage, you know, the free time that you have. And I think the relationships that we have in our schools and developing those kind of connections with our students are paramount to the success of a student when they transition into the workforce or into college. So those are some of the things that we are really focusing on in our district, making sure that students understand the responsibilities that they have, and we're giving them those opportunities to be successful. We're leading them forward and saying, show us what you can apply now into the real world.
Representative Ward. Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually have several questions. Superintendent Graff, I was really interested when I heard about your position, and congratulations. Perhaps it would help me, and I think others would be interested in your background and how you were connected to this social-emotional learning and how that is so important to the academic success as well as the social success of students. Could you tell us a little bit about that, and then I have another question. Superintendent Graff.
Madam Chair, Representative Ward, thank you for the congratulations. As I said, it's an honor to be here in Minneapolis Public Schools. As someone who lived in many different parts of the United States, who spent time in six different schools in my elementary years, I understand what mobility looks like. I understand what poverty looks like, spending time in some of the most impoverished places in the nation, as well as some of the most diverse places in the nation. And I think to the point that was made earlier about, you know, how do you have students who achieve academically in a school setting yet struggle when they get out into places of work or pursuing post-secondary education? That to me is in part because we need to have a greater emphasis and focus on the work around social-emotional learning and understanding how students are aware of their own skills, their emotions, how they navigate that, understanding what's happening around them in their community. And as a former teacher, I saw that in my students. I saw my students who were able to achieve very highly in academics, and I saw a need for them to be able to achieve in the area of navigating the community. So I always told students, I said, I want for you to be able to be ready for anything, you know, respectful, responsible, and ready out in the world. So social-emotional learning, I think, for me, you know, you have to have certain elements of it in your systems. You have to have a clear policy around the standards and what practices you need to provide for students. You need to make sure that you have direct instruction so students are actually seeing those skills being taught, and then you infuse it into everything. It's part of your climate. When you walk into a school, you have a certain feel, and that should be a feeling of safety, of high high expectations of achievement in academics, and also a place of welcoming and learning. You know, our students need to be able to find themselves in a school where they feel comfortable to express, you know, whatever passion they have and those learning opportunities. That's what we create. When we create that independent ownership, we prepare them for decisions that they're going to be making outside of our school walls and out in the community. So I feel very strongly about the potential that we have here in Minneapolis, as well as in the state of Minnesota, to develop that.
Representative Board. Thank you, Madam Chair. I think you've described very well, anecdotally, and it's been my experience as well, that people learn in relationship.
Yeah.
Without the relationship, it's the learning may be superficial, but it's really not retained and deep unless there is that relationship. So can you tell us a little bit about the data on that?
Superintendent Graff.
Madam Chair, one of the statistics I will share with you, and this is done from research that took place probably 5 years ago, when you have students representing strong skills of self-awareness, self-management, social awareness, social management, relationships, the ability to problem solve, when they are able to demonstrate that, their academic achievement is 10 to 15 percentage points higher for their learning. And interestingly enough, when you look at that for students who are African American, it's 30 percentage points higher. So I think it just reinforces further the benefit of what we're providing. Not only do you get that those skills for students to be successful after school, you actually apply more work to supporting the foundation of their academics. And this research has been out there. One of the leading organizations that does work on this is the Collaborative for Academic and Social Emotional Learning,
mm-hmm.
which is an organization that's been around for a number of years. But I think what's most interesting about the organization is that there's a very intentional connection to academics. They don't see this as a separate piece. It's a collaborative for academics and social-emotional learning.
Well, Superintendent Graff, that means, you know, that teachers have to have a great base coming out of their teacher preparation programs because, you know, what you're describing here is teachers have to be super people. And to develop relationships with all sorts of students and still keep academics number one, you know, is a huge challenge. Representative Ward, I have to move on because we have to hear from St. Paul. Representative Kunesh-Podein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Superintendent Graff. I am a library media specialist in Robbinsdale, just next door to you. I started my career in North Minneapolis. I did my student teaching at Anderson Open. And I feel like I want to thank Minneapolis for the training, the years that I was there. It really set the base and my whole mindset on building relationships and the diversity and the richness that that brings. We get a lot of students from Minneapolis. There's a lot of open enrolled, and I'm sure you get plenty of ours as well. So I'm just wondering what kind of a collaborative program or relationship you have with neighboring school districts, especially as students are moving in and out of the different districts, and how we can build that continuity of support for those students. Thank you.
Superintendent Graff.
Madam Chair, Representative, you know, being new to the metro area, I've had the privilege and honor to meet with the superintendent of Robbinsdale, but that's exactly what I envision happening here in the state of Minnesota, is that greater collaboration. You know, I'm someone that comes from greater Minnesota, so I know it very well. And I'm now, again, in the opportunity to share some of that knowledge here in the Minneapolis public schools area. So I think we have to do more networking and more communication around what we're doing to collaborate for students, the support that we need to provide for teachers. You know, Madam Chair mentioned that they have to do so much work and so much to focus on. And I think what we can do through these conversations is figure out how can we help them. You know, what can we take off their plate, or what can we do to further support the challenges that they're facing in support of their students? So I'll go back to, again, the you know, stabilizing the families with the employment, the housing, the mental health support, all of those things. When we're able to do that, we take some of that burden off of our classroom teachers who work very passionately and are so committed to supporting students. So the great opportunities there for more collaboration, and Superintendent Jenkins and I have met, you know, but certainly need to have more discussion about what needs they have similar to our needs, and I know they are similar. We just have a higher concentration of some of those needs, and how we can do a better job of sharing best practices so that, you know, we're not reinventing the wheel.
Representative Pryor.
Thank you.
Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I want to go back to what you said before, which was, I think, very inspirational, the idea of high expectations and high support. And to begin with, just the idea that, yes, we do have high expectations for all the students in Minneapolis Public Schools. Our state needs this educated group of people to move forward into our workforce and be our future. So we do have the highest expectations for your success, and that because of your success, it means the success of your students. And I do have to comment that I have high expectations that I know that you've been succeeding, that Fu and I are from the same undergraduate institution, the same college that happens to be in Representative Bly's district. So we know that there is success, and that that we are fellow alumni, even though I came from Greater Minnesota, Austin, Minnesota. So we all come together in some way. But I want to get back to what you said about high support and go back again to what you were talking about with the grants for mental health. So what percentage of schools or what percentage of students do you think are now getting access to this kind of support that we know is so going to be so critical in so many ways for their success?
Superintendent Graff.
Madam Chair, Representative, I look back over my shoulder because I don't have those statistics, but I will ask staff that we get those stats for you. But what I will say about the mental health and the support, full-service community schools, we were fortunate enough to receive funding and support for that, and one of our schools, Green Central, which is one of the first schools that I visited last spring when I was doing my tour of Minneapolis Public Schools. The ability for them to have a location that offers support services for families, and it's for families who have children in that school, but being able to be proactive as possible so that the students get those resources there if available, which means they don't have to miss school. They don't have to be taken away from school time. They don't have to find, you know, one more person to try and connect with. It's all right there in that space. And I know from my previous work, we did a similar thing in my previous district, and we found the attendance to be improving. We found the relationships and those connections with our kids to be improving. When we're talking about middle school, where you have, you know, a lot going on in the life of a young adolescent, and then you have such a short period of time to make those connections, you know, 2 to 3 years, depending on the middle school years, it's important that you have those supports in place. So, again, I would say that's a perfect example of what needs to happen. And I will also say the idea of mental health, it's one of those that it doesn't have boundary. It's not limited to finances, you know, your income level. It's not limited to your race, to your gender. And I think that's one of the things that I've seen in my 25 years plus in education, is that it touches everyone on some level. And I'll go back to the example I shared earlier where the young lady was telling me, you know, what are we going to do in our schools to help this? Because it affects my family, it affects me. And I think too often it affects many people, and they don't know how to go about addressing it until it manifests itself in a way that is traumatic for more than just that individual, but many others, unfortunately.
I think we have someone at the testifying table who wants to perhaps share a bit of data. Welcome. Please say your name for the record to begin.
Madam Chair, Josh Down, Minneapolis Schools. I simply wanted to add one little bit of information. Representative Pryor, the school-based mental health grants are something that have been supported by both Republicans and Democrats, and I greatly appreciate the fact that it has been a bipartisan effort of this body. But there are 19 schools in Minneapolis that don't receive those supports. And we want to extend those to not only those schools, but some of the schools that do receive those supports are just part-time. so the therapist isn't there long enough to meet the needs of all those students. So when the superintendent talked about the young lady at one of our high schools who was 30th on the waiting list, they actually have a therapist, but that person isn't there enough to meet the demand. So I do look forward to working with this committee of folks on both sides of the aisle to expand those. And it isn't just education. This is human HHS as well. So,
and we're going to hear that in the working group report, a great need for more mental health. So thank you, Superintendent Graff and Mr. Donham and others who came. We need to move on so we give St. Paul a chance to be heard. Welcome, St. Paul. Thank you again, Superintendent
Thank
Graff.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And Minneapolis. Members, those of you who didn't get to ask questions, I'm sure that you might have similar questions for St. Paul. So, now we have an interim superintendent, so we're very happy. We can pull up another chair for you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, hello, my name is John Tyne, and it's my privilege to serve as superintendent of St. Paul Public Schools. You can tell by the color of my hair and probably the lines in my face that this is not my first roundup. I've spent 45 years working in public education in Minnesota. I've worked in rural Minnesota, greater Minnesota. I've worked in suburban schools, and now it's my privilege to work in an urban school. I could tell you many things that I've learned about St. Paul and many of the misconceptions that I've had or that I kept to myself have been erased. I found it to be a warm, engaging, dedicated place with fabulous students, wonderful teachers. Minneapolis just mentioned the homeless population, and when you talk about the homeless population in Minnesota, over 5,000 of those students are in Minneapolis and St. Paul. And that's like taking the population of Montevideo, Minnesota, in rural Minnesota. Oh, a chair.
Oh,
nice.
We just want to make sure we pick you up on the mic.
Now, at my age, that's pretty important to have a chair, too. So, but it's like taking the population of Minnesota or Montevideo and just making it homeless all in one night. And that's really a scary thing. Now, I'm privileged to be here today with a number of really excellent educators, and the most important people in our schools, our students. And I, if it's okay with you, Chair Erickson, I would like to yield some of my time, and I'll step back and let Kia Shia and Amy Ensign talk about their experiences in St. Paul Public Schools, and I'm sure they'll be able to answer many more questions and give you much more insight than I'll be able to. Amy and Shia.
Well, thank you very much. And who would like to start?
I can go ahead and start.
Please say your name for the record again and begin.
I'm Amy Ensign, and I've been teaching at Johnson Senior High on the east side of St. Paul for 8 years. Before that, I taught in Baltimore City, and then started my career actually in Red Lake at the high school. And I have to say, the moment that I walked into St. Paul Public Schools, it's pretty much hooked. I feel like it's a school that has an amazing collaborative approach. Our colleagues are really united. We keep the students in the front of our minds at all times. Our administrators are incredibly supportive, and it just makes my room more teachable. And so when conflicts do come up, because they're teenagers and that's part of life, and then they come to us obviously with some struggles from home, I feel really supported by our social workers. We have a chemical health counselor. We have, administrators that aren't just worried about disciplining kids, but also restoring them, getting them back into classrooms, fixing relationships. And all of that happens swiftly, and I don't feel like my lessons are really interrupted. I'm able to teach. It's always been really teachable. And that's pretty different from the other districts that I've been part of, unfortunately. I'm excited to talk to you guys today, because every time the media reports an incident in St. Paul or Minneapolis, it kind of breaks my heart a little bit, because it's really just one narrative about what it's like to be a city kid and to be working in the city. And it's not at all the atmosphere or the feeling that actually exists. If you, like, please come to Johnson unannounced, just show up, like, you can hang out with us. And you'll see right away, it's a really calm, welcoming atmosphere. It's a tight-knit community. And it's peaceful, you know. Of course, there are moments where, you know, issues come up, but for the most part, it's safe. And we trust each other, and we care deeply about our students. And so when I see stories that really just paint our students as violent, there's a columnist in the Pioneer Press who once called children on the east side feral, and I couldn't believe that our local newspaper published such a bigoted language about our students, because all it does is reinforce those stereotypes about particularly our students of color. And then, you know, that just continues to take away opportunities that they deserve to have, and it makes people nervous around them in public, and it makes people think, you know, I don't want to send my kids to those schools with those people, and that is just a dangerous, dangerous narrative. And we've been working in the last few years to be even more intentional about our school climate, and we've been doing that through a leadership program. And we've had, you know, multiple journalists, actually maybe up to 10 in the last year and a half, come to our school to take a look at our leadership program. And every time, I'm a little disappointed because they come with, of course, like there's an angle ahead of time. And then we share our day, we share our time with them, and they leave not telling our story. They don't tell the harder story, which is how great of a place it is. They don't do the work of trying to make that newsworthy. It's so much easier to look at conflict and get that on the front page of the paper, when really we should be building upon the strengths that are happening in our school. So what we've been doing and working on the last couple years at Johnson in particular is a new leadership program. We kind of just threw out student council. We said goodbye and kind of held our breath. And, you know, while I was the advisor of that program, we were really proud of the work that we had done. We had to take an honest look at who we were calling leaders in our school. And it didn't actually represent our whole student body. And it was the top students, right, with quotation marks, because seriously, all of our students are amazing. And we said, anybody who wants to try to be a leader, come on board. I don't care how many referrals you have. I don't care what your grades are. If you want to try it out, if you want to try to be a leader and help have a voice, have some power in your school, come join us. And that has been transformative for us. I feel like the building is even more calm and more supportive than it's ever been. So what we've done is we basically put a call out in assembly to our juniors and seniors. 300 of them, as opposed to 30, came forward and said, yeah, I want to try that. I want to try to be a student leader and experience, you know, the good and the bad. And so we give our students 15 minutes a day of an advisory where we ask the teacher to basically, you're there, but you're on the sideline, or else you can participate like a student. But the advisory leaders, these 300 students, run that 15 minutes. It's their time. Sometimes we talk about serious issues. We have important discussions. Sometimes it's giving inside advice that, like, maybe Kiyoshia, as an upperclassman, knows, like, how to navigate a certain teacher's class or how to make sure that you're really involved in the school community. And sometimes it's just being a student and someone who's young and, you know, releasing some energy and enjoying each other, building community. So there's a variety of things that happen. But the activities that happen in advisory are developed by a senior leadership class. So we have students who come up with and generate all those activities. Basically, we have stepped aside and made time in our day for students to be leaders and to be in charge of it and to help them make decisions with our principal and to feel like they have multiple ways to access power and voice and even choice in our school. I feel really, really proud of the fact that we are so much closer to equitable in that opportunity because high school really is that training ground for our students in terms of their leadership skills, and we don't want to eliminate certain kids from those opportunities. But we also made sure that we made it part of the school day. If that's truly a value of ours, and we want a school climate that's calm, peaceful, and united, then we have to prioritize that. And that takes money. And I don't know how my principal magically, like, works it. But somehow he makes it happen. And, you know, we've made that fit in the school day. You know, so we're not competing with students' outside lives. We're not competing with their sports, their extracurriculars, their obligations at home, which oftentimes can hold kids back from being part of those kinds of initiatives, and that's really great.
So Ms. Tyne, has that that strategy that you're using cut down on behaviors in the classroom or on the assaults that have occurred in the St. Paul district?
Yeah, so I can say that in my school, there are not violent incidents in classrooms. There are situations that happen in the hallway, but in the classroom, it's a pretty peaceful place. So I was kind of surprised to hear that from earlier. As far as, like, I always feel like I find out that there was a conflict long after. Like, it's not quite the frenzy that it used to be even just, like, 4 or 5 years ago. You know, students in the hall with cell phones out, you know, like, interested in it. Like, people are just kind of in their classrooms doing their things. And then our administrators and our social workers scoop them up and start working away at what's going on, what the problem is. I think that it's allowed students to have more opportunities to see positive role models within their school that look like them. I think it's allowed for students to feel like if something is bothering them, whether it's how a teacher is operating a class or even a rule in school, they have a place where they can share that concern. And that avoids a lot of conflict, too, right there, right, because you're not getting fully escalated.
So, Superintendent Tyne, can you comment on the question I just asked across the district lines?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm pleased to announce that St. Paul Public Schools has invested a lot of time and effort to make our school more equitable and more safe for all of our students and our staff and our visitors and members of the community. We're proud of our schools, and the data shows that that's starting to work. Our suspensions have decreased by 21% from the first quarter this year to last year. Also, you know that SROs in our office sometimes were involved in conflicts with students and taking charge. Last year, during the first quarter, we had 21 of those incidents between officers and students. This year, we've had, I'm proud to say, one, and that's one too many. We'd like to reduce that down to zero. One of the reasons that's happened is because we've moved to community relations and how to develop relationships between the students and the officers. Our officers are there to support, and we know what the responsibilities of the administration happen to be in the building. They are there to deal with students and to address issues of discipline that need to be addressed. And our officers are there to build relationships with the students. So it's been very positive for us.
So, Superintendent Tyne, what are you doing at the middle school level? We heard Minneapolis make mention of that's really where the behaviors start to change, and so they've addressed that. What has St. Paul done at that level, at the middle school level?
First of all, we've invested a lot of effort. Last year, our school board made a decision to invest into support staff into that building, and we've also invested into community elders within our building, too. People who live in the community, know the community, and are out among our students. And it's almost like having grandparents or, I guess, community elders working in the with our students. And it's been remarkably successful. And I think that has a lot to do with the reduction in probably dust-ups or altercations. We've worked very hard to make sure that
counselors, nurses, psychologists, other support staff are there, but also community members, because we all know it's a community that makes a difference in a school. When you work and live in a small school, it's a very tightly bound group of individuals that work together. That's the kind of relationships that we're trying to develop within even a larger environment. We serve over 38,000 students, and I'm really excited to tell you. You know, usually what happens during a year, you lose students after the October 1st count. Well, we did. We lost one student out of 38,573, which means that we're hanging on to our kids, we're keeping them in school, we're educating them. I've had a chance to visit high schools. I've watched teachers who are absolutely so committed to kids, principals who realize that families are being challenged every day. And I think, Madam Chair, I shared with you about Dominic when the, if you don't mind, if I could share with everybody, the Speaker of the House visited one of our schools. And we were visiting, and all of a sudden, a little guy, and I'll call him Dominic, walked in, and his hair was tousled, and his shirt was, you could tell he slept in it. And it was obvious that he had just probably arrived at school and really was, his life, he needed a little help. Out of the back room, two angels, a nurse and an aide, came out and said, Dominic, how are you today? Come on in back here, we want to talk to you. And while we visited out in front, all of a sudden, about 10 minutes later, seemed like less than that, Dominic walked out, his hair combed, his face washed, a clean shirt on. Somebody from food service came up, Dominic, come on down, your breakfast is waiting for you. That meant that Dominic was going to go to a classroom, and he wasn't going to look like the kid that didn't fit. He wasn't going to look like the kid who didn't have breakfast. He wasn't going to look like the kid with a dirty shirt. He was going to look like somebody that was ready to go to school and to learn. And that's what we're trying to do with. And Minneapolis can share as many stories as we can like that. Also that day when I was standing in the hall, a young man walked by, and you could just tell he was full of energy. And he looked up at me and said, hey, you Trump?
No.
And I said, no. And he looked at me and said, are you sure? And he pulled on my tie, and it happened to be one. So I'll tell you, I've had some wonderful experiences working in St. Paul Public Schools, and it's been a real thrill. Kids are the key. We can talk all day about discipline, but it's one-on-one relationships, how you get along with kids. And Superintendent Graff is right. You know, he's going to make things happen in Minneapolis. I have great faith. I know that the next person and the most important job our board has is to hire a fabulous superintendent who's going to really lead that district and make it a great success. So
thank
I'm really proud of that. But I'm prouder,
yeah,
Madam
I
Chair,
want to hear from
of our students.
So do we. So please say your name for the record and begin. We have some questions, and we need to hear from the report as well, the people who bring in the report. So if you would say your name for the record and talk about how St. Paul's doing.
My name is Kishia Shongya, and I'm a senior at Johnson Junior High. And freshman year coming in, it was, like, really chaotic for me. I'm not as quiet as I used to be, but going in seniors, you're like, oh, we're not going to beat you up. We're not going to push you into lockers and throw you in the trash like it would be in movies. And me being really small, I was just always afraid to, like, interact with upperclassmen. And then my junior year, we started the leadership program, and I just felt like I was given, like, a voice to be working with, that I was given the chance to step up and be a leader to the freshmen that were afraid, like I was. And my junior year, my first year as, like, a leader in training, I got to help a fellow freshman with her schoolwork, and she went from, like, having, like, 300 missing work assignments to building a better connection with her teachers, and I helped her organize her work, and use a planner. She's never used a planner before. Mm-hmm. And she went from having the most missing assignments to having zero within the next semester. And I feel like students can identify with other students, especially since we're so diverse in St. Paul, that it's hard to identify with other students of color, just like, oh, like, African-Americans always have problems with fights and, like, family members dying, and Hmong students are, like, disciplined, like, they can't do anything, and that's different for me. I'm very Americanized, and I get to be a part of school activities. I get to lead, and I get to have a voice, and I love the fact that we are given the power to say what we feel, and teachers can understand where we're coming from. This year as a senior, it's completely changed from last year. I feel like students are more personable to each other, and we connect more than ever. It's hard to, with the different generations, to kind of like speak to each other, because there are a lot of like different slang words. Like, I don't even know half of the new slang words out there, and I'm just like so confused. But like the naughty students, even they come to senior leaders and they're like, we have ideas, we want to talk. And that's completely different from when I was a freshman, where like all the crazy kids just like save themselves, they don't want to be involved. Like, I know a lot of freshmen who are really crazy, and they can't wait to be a junior and to be a part of the leadership program. And it wasn't like that when I was a freshman. Nobody wanted to do anything. Nobody wanted to speak up. And now we're all about voicing our opinions and coming with ideas to be collaborative and to connect with each other.
Well, thank you very much. And I think you can be so influential among your students. And Johnson, congratulations for developing that kind of program to help the students. Representative Mariani has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll try to be quick because I know we have the task force I want to hear, and so I'll just make a few quick observations and actually not ask a question so we can get out to others as well. But, Superintendent, good to see you. As always, thank you for assuming the leadership in St. Paul's schools. I've had the privilege of working with you over the years on a number of issues, and I'm real proud to have you in our school district. And Amy and Siasha, thank you for the work that you're doing. More importantly, thank you for the stories that you're sharing here today. It has greatly disturbed me the way my school district has been horribly mischaracterized in very extreme terminologies relative to this issue of student adult relationships, behaviors, et cetera. All my children are products of all schools. One is a black Puerto Rican woman who learned Slavic languages at Central High School and spent a year and a half teaching in Moscow. My daughter graduated from there over a decade ago and is now head of student support services at an HBCU in Dallas, Texas. That high school stands second to no other high school in the nation, and the data is there to prove that. What I heard here just now are a couple of things. One is vitally, and we heard this from Minneapolis schools as well, vitally important for us to play a role in making sure you all have the resources to build those relationships with students, to be able to have those interventions where needed with students, to be about student support services. And I think that there's a common bipartisan belief in that here, and I hope that bears itself out this year. The other thing I heard, quite frankly, is that we should really, you didn't say it, but I'll say it, we should really temper our impulses to micromanage you in terms of a number of issues, including this issue as well. We often hear about local control, how important it is for all our independent school districts, and then we get these sensationalized stories, and then we get pulled into wanting to micromanage your relationships with students. I hope that we resist that this year. I hope we listen carefully to what these school districts and other school districts are telling us, and the task force as well, about helpful ways that we could provide the space for you all, along with the resources, to build those relationships. So thank you for your leadership and your sharing very human, very real stories with us here today.
And thank you, Representative Mariani, for those very important statements. We're going to move on, thank you very much, St. Paul, to the working group. If they would come forward, please. We don't want to pay short shrift to them, since this is probably the foundation for any kind of changes we would make. And members that
discipline working group report is in your packets, and we are so pleased to have part of that working group with us today to report. Members, they have laid out the legislation for you and then their recommendations, the belief statement, and then, of course, some other information about the working group's design. So welcome very much to our committee. Let's see, I think, get my notes here. Ms. Pfeffercorn, you're the co-chair of the Student Discipline Working Group, and I'd like you to introduce yourself and begin.
Good morning. My name is Marika Pfeffercorn. I am a director at the Minnesota Education Equity Partnership and co-chair of the Solutions Not Suspensions, as well as the Discipline Task Force. I have a few prepared remarks. The flow of this presentation will do a high-level overview of the recommendations, share with you our belief statements, and then we can engage in some additional questions that you may have regarding our process and our outcomes. So, good morning,
good morning,
Madam Chair and committee members. It really is a pleasure to be here with you this morning. I see the excitement on your faces. We're talking about education, and this is important work. As I present our recommendations and some of my personal thoughts to you today, the situation around school discipline in Minnesota feels even more urgent than it did last spring when this working group was actually created. Just last week, a troubling video of a student fight in Minneapolis began to make the rounds. This video, like others before it, raises some legitimate concerns for policymakers, educators, and families. There might be an impulse here at the legislature to take swift action in response to that video to make it easier for schools to remove students. This is an impulse that I would caution against. Because soon, before that particular fight, earlier before that particular fight took place, the Minnesota Department of Education released new discipline data showing that despite the growing research of the negative effects that exclusionary discipline and a public narrative that schools are powerless to discipline students, school removals are actually on the rise. We lost 103,000 days of lost instruction time because of school suspensions. In 2015-2016 school year, there were 51,667 incidents of suspensions, expulsions across Minnesota's K-12 public schools, compared to 46,442 in 2014-2015. This is an 11% increase in just 1 year, a year since we've had the conversation about bringing together a task force. A whopping 37% of these exclusions were for disorderly and disruptive behavior. It's a shockingly vague and subjective category, which fighting and a number of other considered discipline incidents can be included to, so we don't actually know what all these disorderly and disruptives actually represent. The truth is that schools are already removing students, most often for nonviolent behavior. Current law already gives them that power. They do not need more. What schools do need is additional support to help educators and other trained adults in the building prevent and de-escalate situations like that fight, and more guidance around how to remove and reintegrate students when the removal is used as a last resort. Honoring students' due process and their constitutional right to a free public education is core to this issue. And we will talk more about what that entails. Ultimately, we need to move away from failed exclusionary discipline practices and towards proven preventative and restorative strategies that improve student behavior and outcomes long-term, as we mentioned earlier today, that benefits our economy and specifically our workforce. I believe that this legislature should use our working group's recommendations, not a knee-jerk reaction to last week's video, as a starting point to giving schools, educators, and students what they need. Let's begin here. Thankfully, we have given you a lot of work to work with as we've reached agreement on a variety of topics. In particular, I'm eager to see action on our recommendations to establish, communicate, and clarify what due process looks like for all student dismissals. We'd like to see improvement in the school, state school's discipline data collection and reporting, including far greater detail on student interactions with school resource officers. We'd like to see additional training offered for educators and SROs in best practices and behavior intervention strategies, and require that if a student does not repeat the behavior for 1 year, their history of physical assault or violent behavior not be reported to future teachers, giving the student a fair chance, a second chance at school success. As with many convenings of passionate people with varied opinions and experiences, the working group also experienced some challenges and dead ends. We were unable to define willful in establishing grounds for dismissal. Personally, I believe this qualifier is incredibly important, and I urge the legislature to preserve it in statute. If a definition is developed, I believe it must honor students' due process. I personally believe that the makeup of the working group itself was problematic. Last year, the Solutions Not Suspensions Coalition had to fight tooth and nail to secure spots in this group for those most directly and disproportionately impacted by the school discipline. Thankfully, to House representatives, we were able to get additional names added to that working group. But those people that are most disproportionately impacted by school discipline are black students, American Indian students, and students with disabilities, as well as their families and advocates. And that was in short supply for representation in our working group. We had a few spots, but not nearly enough. As last week's presentation in the Senate, a representative from one of the many professional associations that was included in this working group said, "If we're not at the table, then we're on the menu." Well, I worry that with this working group, impacted students and families were on the menu. And I believe that the legislature should use our working group's recommendations. Sorry, I just went back. We're on the menu. And that as a result, our recommendations do not go nearly far enough to help. Now it is time for policymakers to review and expand upon our recommendations and set the table for further conversations that focus on interventions and prioritize those who are most directly harmed by current policies and yet too often are overlooked. Finally, I hope the legislature will take real, meaningful, but measured action during the 2017 session to enact policies that will move our state away from our failed exclusionary discipline and towards restorative approaches that we know work. And as a grounding for the place that we land as a working group, I just want to frame how we came to this place, how we worked through this process, and how I hope you'll think about the recommendations that we present as you consider them. And that is, this is the belief statement that as a group we came up with. We believe that Minnesota students can all succeed and graduate from high school, and out-of-school suspension is a barrier to learning and on-time graduation. We believe that Minnesota students may come to school with behaviors or symptoms related to mental illness. They may have been exposed to recent or historical trauma and may be in distress. We believe that Minnesota students deserve developmentally appropriate disciplinary practices and absolutely have a right to due process. We believe that Minnesota schools must be physically and emotionally safe for students and staff members. We believe that Minnesota schools can eliminate the disproportionality in the use of disciplinary practices on students. In the 2015-2016 school year, the following student groups were dismissed from school at a disproportionate rate: black students, particularly African American males; American Indian students, particularly American Indian males; Latino students, multi-race students, students with a disability, male students, particularly those in one or more of the above groups, LGBTQ students. The list goes on. This is a reflection of all of our students. We believe that Minnesota schools can increase the use of positive interventions in lieu of discipline practices. Through such practices as positive behavioral interventions and supports, and as we call it, PBIS, social-emotional learning, as Superintendent Graff mentioned earlier, and restorative and just practices. We believe that Minnesota schools must have enhanced funding in order to improve school disciplinary practices and increase positive outcomes for students. Increased funding is necessary in order to add and implement strategies that create a positive and positive school culture, provide support and training for staff members and staff educators, and increase support personnel in schools. So many of the observations that both Minneapolis and St. Paul Public Schools identified many of these things in the list that they are asking for in regards for support, whether it's mental health, whether it's student support staff, or mental health services. So while it is not an exhaustive list of recommendations, there are some strong pieces in here for you to consider. And I want to open, Madam Chair, I'd like to open up with, we're available for questions.
Thank you, Ms. Bepricorn. I think we have two others at the table from whom we may want to hear. Mm-hmm. So whoever wants to go first, I know I have a Kristen Craig teacher listed, and we'd love to hear from you. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm Kristen Craig. I am currently the Dean of Students at Hiawatha College Prep in Minneapolis, and I've been working on discipline issues with E4E and a local nonprofit working with educators in Minnesota. I've worked with them to develop a guide for teachers and administrators to use on alternatives to suspension, including things like restorative justice practices and social emotional learning. And then I was invited to be part of the student discipline working group. In my 8 years prior to being a dean of students, I was a special ed teacher working with students with emotional and behavior disorders. And I watched time and time again as my students who tended to be black and brown students were put out of their classes and their schools. I was co-teaching a ninth grade science class one day, and one of my female students, who I'll call Raven, had referred to her teacher as girl as she was talking to her teacher. The teacher took offense to that and went and got into her face and said, "You will never call me girl again," and sent her out to the office. Raven was then suspended from school for that act, a nonviolent act. When she returned to school, there was no restorative conversation or opportunity to repair with the teacher, but she went back into class, and 2 weeks later, she was suspended again for fighting. Then she was recommended for expulsion. However, since she was Raven was a special education student, she was then referred to a federal setting 3 special education program, further kind of taking her away from her peers. 3 months after that, she dropped out of school. And 6 months after that, she was pregnant. I always wonder about Raven. I wonder if she would have been where she would be if her mostly white teachers and administrators would have actually thought about restorative practices, would have thought about suspending for nonviolent behaviors as opposed to just suspending because a teacher was hurt by the comment, which in Raven's mind was an endearing comment. I wonder how things would be different if Raven and her teacher would have been able to restore their relationship after the incident. And I tell you this because this is kind of what drives my work on a daily basis. As a dean of students now, where I make decisions on when students are going to be removed from class, and I help to restore conversations between students or between students and staff, I wonder how we can do something differently. And I believe that Minnesota has to change the way that we do discipline so that we can have young people like Raven that are able to have the education that they deserve and that we want our students to have. In the case of Raven and many Minnesota students, exclusion isn't working. It hurts our graduation rates and is impacting our economy. One suspension is associated with a 32% increased likelihood of dropping out of school. And students who drop out of high school are 63 times more likely to end up in the criminal justice system. So if we could have just 10% more of males in Minnesota graduate from high school, we could see an $11 million increase in state and local tax revenues, which makes student discipline a civil rights and an economic issue for Minnesota. Some of the solutions that Marika referred to in the Student Discipline Working Group, which are also included in the Student Inclusion and Engagement Act, suggest things like more mental health services, teacher and administrative training on alternatives to suspensions like PBIS and restorative justice, improve student due process procedures before, during, and after suspension, and better data collection and reporting. And I believe that these things can help us as educators improve the school experience for all of our students, even ones like Raven. So I want to thank you all for allowing me to speak to you today, and I hope that you all will seriously consider the recommendations of the Student Discipline Working Group and the Student Inclusion and Engagement Act, because Minnesota has the opportunity to give all of our students, even ones like Raven, the education that they deserve.
Thank you, Ms. Craig. And we have one other testifier.
Yes,
please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Carol Quinn, and I am representing on the task force. I represented the Minnesota State School Social Workers Association, and I just have brief comments. First of all, I am a Patrick Henry High School graduate also. I won't say what class. And I have worked for the last 30 years as a school social worker in North Minneapolis, the last 26 years for Minneapolis Public Schools, 12 years in a program for kids with emotional behavior disorders. Children and families that are getting up every day to do the best they can, and we have to help support them in that. So I think this is a good document to work on. The task force worked very hard on this. There were some issues. Yes, I believe we need more diversity in these situations. The students I primarily worked with over the years are students of color. Never met a mom who didn't want the best for her child. I never met a student who wanted to fail. All behavior is purposeful. What is the student saying when they act out? And I've spent years running peacemaker groups, doing home visits, being a conduit between teachers, administrators, parents, students, and good people doing good work. But we need the support from the policymakers, too. So thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Quinn. Very well said. Representative Bly, you've been waiting to ask some questions, and I want to make sure you get that chance before we adjourn.
I appreciate that, Chair. A couple of comments and then perhaps a question, but I'm very heartened by the things I've heard this morning. 30 years ago, I was a EBD teacher in a self-contained classroom, and there were several things I learned from that experience. And one of them I just heard you kind of allude to, and that is that all behavior is communication, and a student is trying to communicate something. Also, that behaviors, oftentimes bad behaviors, are an opportunity to deepen relationships and understand more about what's going on. And so I think we've come a long way, perhaps, back when I was working 30 years ago on these some of these topics, and it's encouraging for me to hear the work of your work group and also the superintendents who have come and talked to us about their understanding of these problems. And I think it's encouraging that we are reaching a point where I think we will engage and in community, engage with students, and really make an effort, take responsibility for some of what's happening ourselves, and reach out. I learned that there were teachers back then who were more than willing to work with students who struggled, and it was very encouraging to find that. But there were many who just didn't understand and needed to be educated as well. And I think that we're well on our way if this carries forward to helping teachers gain that experience and understanding, and I'm glad to hear the words that I've heard today. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Fly. Those were important words for us to hear. Representative Christensen, since you were chair of this bill that went forward to bring about this working group, do you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for your presentation. I authored the bill to create the working group, and that was, you know, out of an abundance of you know, concern from constituents and on my own of the situations we saw in schools, the kind of violent instances, and as well as a big concern with the disparities in suspensions and the number of suspensions, and I, you know, continue in that concern on both fronts. I'm a little bit honestly disappointed in some of the recommendations that, you know, I'm not sure that there's a lot of creative recommendations in here. The really very much reform. It's a lot of talk about increasing in funding, which is important, obviously, but I'm not sure that there's a lot of creative approaches in here. I'm also concerned especially about talking about the one-year rule with as far as a violent instance and not informing teachers. You know, I'm really proud of the teachers that we have in Minnesota. I think they're fantastic educators, dedicated to their students, and do a fantastic job. And I think putting more information in the hands of teachers is always a good thing, and it allows them to better serve their students. And I'm really concerned that we're not really respecting necessarily the professionalism of our teachers in that recommendation. You know, I think teachers are professionals. They're great at what they do, and having more information about students, more information in their classroom, allows them to better educate students, allows them to make sure all of their students, that everyone in the situation is safe, and that everyone is ensuring, and that they're ensuring that everyone gets a great education. And I think that's really important, and I just want to make sure we're keeping in mind the importance of the professionalism of our teachers in this.
Ms. Craig, did you want to respond to that as a professional?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Christensen, with all due respect, I believe wholeheartedly that our group was looking at the teaching profession as a profession, and we want to raise the level of professionalism that teachers have. I think we see that. I also think that some people don't see teachers as a professional piece. I also want to say that as someone who's working with middle school students, where we discussed earlier that some of these issues begin, that I have to remind myself on a daily basis, I am teaching these kids not just reading, writing, math, but I'm teaching them how to be citizens that we want our students to be when they graduate from high school and they're college and career ready. And so that means giving second chances when we know that their frontal lobes are not developed and we know that they are learning how to do some of these things that we feel like come easy. And I think we forget that we were all middle schoolers. And we made some really poor, I made really poor decisions, I don't know about you all, as a middle school student, and second chances and opportunities to restore and learn are, I think, what is at the heart of that idea that we would take away after a year some of the mistakes that our students made. If we carried around everything that we did wrong as teenagers, we all probably wouldn't be sitting here today.
Ms. Pepperford, just very quickly, because we need to adjourn because we have another committee coming in.
Absolutely. Madam Chair, Representative Christensen, I'd like to respond to your piece about the creative approaches, and I do believe that we would have come up with some more creative approaches had we had a much broader group that was represented at the table. We had a significant amount of professional associations. We did not have a lot of people outside of that space that we're able to contribute to the conversation and say what they really think is possible. A lot of the conversation landed in what was compliance. I would also like to say that one of the pieces of the recommendations that the group really did find common ground on was specifically on the informing the teacher about the violent act, simply because if you consider a first grade student that has an incident, that will follow them for the entire rest of their K-12 career. And I do not believe a first-grade student that has acted out in the classroom needs to be introduced heretofore with every teacher saying, that's the bad one, that's the bad one, that's the bad one. And as adults that are responsible for teaching and training behavior, we also have to allow children to have second chances. I believe in third, but I'll give you second chances. So I thank you for reconsidering that position and really considering how the task force itself has put forth these recommendations, and there is opportunity to infuse innovative and creative approaches if we have an inclusive process. Thank you.
And thank you, all three of you, for joining us today. Members, I think we're going to have some proposals coming forward. I haven't seen any yet, but I know that we'll be debating these in the future. So we thank you again, all of you who participated today and provided us with information.
Thank
and
you
with that, this meeting is adjourned.